It can take decades for an urban community to develop, but a fraction of that time for it to be torn apart. Each year, urban residents are forced out of their homes, out of their communities, to make way for gentrification or other kinds of urban development. When these individuals are forced to leave their homes, they're also forced to leave behind their histories and cultures. This urban displacement often robs them of support systems as well. It's a focus of this episode of Stats and Stories, where we explore the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics. I'm Rosemary Pennington. Stats and Stories is a production of the American Statistical Association in partnership with Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film. Joining me is regular panelist John Baylor, Emeritus Professor of Statistics at Miami University. Our guest today is Tim Thomas. Thomas is a professional researcher at the University of California, Berkeley, where he served as research director of the Urban Displacement Project. He also founded and serves as the director of the Eviction Research Network. He recently served as the chief research and data officer at the King County Regional Homeless Authority, where he led efforts to use data-driven strategies to address homelessness. Thomas's research focuses on neighborhood change, housing disparity, and urban displacement. His works informed tenant protection laws across the country, as well as the eviction moratorium during the COVID pandemic. Tim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
What is urban displacement?
You know, it's a really good question that we don't talk a lot about. We hear this term about displacement. We hear about terms like gentrification, but I think it's really nice and easy to actually situate this into kind of three buckets, right? There are exclusive neighborhoods, the really expensive neighborhoods we can't really get into, right? These are spaces that more wealthy folks move into, and individuals who are higher income tend to be more mobile. They can move to spaces they want to. They can take advantage of certain areas that have really nice amenities or good networks. You know, they can move downtown or something like that. So those are areas that are kind of blocked off for most of society. And then there's the term gentrification, right? That's where a neighborhood that traditionally was lower income, potentially segregated, has already switched over. And that is a term that was coined in the 1960s. By someone named Ruth Glass, but it really took hold in the 90s, particularly in America, where there's urban revitalization, people moving back to the urban core. And you start to see some kind of disparity in terms of who was able to take advantage of gentrified areas. Gentrification still goes on. There's constant development. You think about the new high-rise buildings that move into, you know, in across entire parts of America. This is not secluded to San Francisco, Seattle, New York. Gentrification is every city, right? And those are spaces that, you know, when I see that, they've just seen a shift and they're kind of starting to lean towards exclusive, but that's not necessarily always the case. Displacement areas are areas that are ripe for investment, but tend to be also starting out as lower income, tending to be segregated. And not all low-income areas are going to gentrify, right? If you think about an urban core, an area that has shifted, right, the rents have gone up in that particular space. Think about a block or a neighborhood. Back in the day, a coffee shop kind of predicted where the new gentrifying space was. Now, I think it's like Trader Joe's and other kind of like commercial spaces are kind of triggering this like, oh, wow, the neighborhood's changed, or this, that, or the other's happened to it. And when I think about displacement, I look for neighborhoods nearby that are lower rent, that tend to be less quote unquote desirable, which is kind of a, you know, I want to be careful with that term because the who deems that desirable is also a very, you know, pretty interesting question. But displacement tends to happen to spaces that are close to gentrifying areas. And I think about displacement within two terms, hard and soft displacement. Soft displacement is the general public, somebody who's making about 80% of the area median income, kind of has a hard time paying the rent. And they're like, well, I don't want to move, but I definitely don't want to be paying these prices, right? So I call that soft displacement. That's middle income folks in America tending to move to other areas. Those people, when they move to certain spaces, may start to gentrify another space that is more affordable. But what ends up happening is that can happen across the board for different demographics. So what's particularly happened for Black and Brown communities is displacement has happened in what were formerly redlined areas, segregated spaces, and pushed them further out to areas further away from the urban core or further away from their networks, from their jobs. People having to, they have to commute in to get to their jobs more. So it causes a lot of, problems across the board. And, granted, they had a quote unquote choice. That's the key word for soft displacement. It doesn't necessarily mean that they wanted to do that. Hard displacement is another topic that I don't think we talk about a lot. That's when you're forced to move. That's where evictions kind of happen. And by and large, I think this is the population that's most vulnerable to homelessness, right? They have nowhere else to go. And when we've done the research on places where people can go, I coined this term highways of migration. If you look at a map, whatever city, and you think about where is it affordable for somebody who's making 80% of the area median income or 50% of the area median income. Now, that 50%, I think, is kind of the rough cutoff where most people are hard displaced tend to be. There's only a few places that they could afford to move to. Maybe they're paying, $1,000 or $800 in rent. What other places in the city have those types of apartments available to them? So at the end of the day, we start to see that only certain neighborhoods are available to that population to move into. So this is kind of like really creating a big problem because we had this issue called segregation that created certain spaces that certain people could move to. And so I think it just creates a huge problem with the histories and the futures with that households face.
As you were talking about this, I mean, this is it, these are concepts that seem fairly accessible. I mean, that as you're describing it, these categories are meaningful and definable. But I just think, boy, it's got to be tough to measure this, and to think about the data sources. So can you talk a little bit about how you operationalize measuring ideas of displacement or gentrification, and what kind of data sources do you access to do so?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. And categorically, it's nice. We started out with just like thresholds of medians, where if a neighborhood or a census tract, which tends to be a rough boundary for a neighborhood, whether or not it was experiencing more or less mobility per se from the US Census, right? But that's highly flawed, right? We're throwing out a lot of useful information by looking at just medians, right? Just the half the threshold there. And also the census data, I mean, that's rough data. That's like, you look at the American Community Survey right now, 2023 is available, but that spans across 5 years. So already when I'm looking at census data, I'm looking at the past by about, 3 to 7 years, right? So it's in, luckily, not luckily, but displacement's a long game. And it happens for a long time, but really what we need, and scholars have really pointed out this problem, what we really need is individual level data that tracks individual moves at a time, right? And we also don't have information on like why people are moving, right? So we can make some assumptions based on certain information. So we developed this tool called the Housing Precarity Risk Model, which is available on our website, evictionresearch.net. And what it does is it actually uses a machine learning model with a Bayesian generalizer. So in other words, it's just a real fancy model that can take hundreds of variables at a time. And it uses residential data. So there's kind of, the crappy coupons we get all the time. There's data collected on us based on credit scores, social media, voting records. And people put that data together and we can get yearly addresses. And so we basically calculate a net migration rate of people by certain incomes inside a census tract. And when we see more people of, say, 50% AMI leaving than coming in, because neighborhoods change all the time. People are moving in and out all the time. And when you see more exit than you see entrance, we call that a pseudo form of loss or displacement, right? We then calculate, there's a lot of data and there's a lot of error because some of that data is not good. So we then, find using the US Census, we kind of validate, do we have a strong enough sample of people from this data set? And then we come up with a best fit and for where we figure out what are the variables that predict this kind of net migration rate for different groups. And then throw that prediction on each census tract across the country to kind of see which areas, what demographic, what census, what data is predicting out migration more than in migration. And we kind of highlight that as being the cases and where we might be experiencing risk of displacement.
I led some students to DC a few years ago, and we spent most of a spring semester studying together. And as part of that trip, we had a tour of the U Street neighborhood of DC with some housing activists who were talking about how that place has gentrified and what the residents have been doing to try to resist gentrification. And I was just reading earlier about attempts to gentrify Anacostia, which was a part of DC where when people were moving into the center of DC that pushed African Americans across the river into Anacostia, and now that is being attempted to gentrify. And both U Street and Anacostia are black parts of DC, black neighborhoods. And I wonder, as I was like listening to you talk, like what can residents in these communities do to kind of resist this attempt at displacement?
I think that's a question I get all the time, and it's difficult. And I think, one of the best ways is to one, be aware of what's going on, be aware of your contributions of what you're doing, supporting local business, all those kind of things are very important. But also advocating for policy, right? And it's not just a one person or one side kind of issue or way to approach things. When in 2019, I was part of Washington state legislation on helping pass some bills on tenant protections and things like that. And I figured out there's what I call the three-legged stool of progressive policy. And what that is, we need advocates to share their stories, right? And they're really, honestly, they have the best research questions. I can come up with the research questions all day. And the second part is data analysts like myself willing to put together the data. The data is the truth. And then third, you need policymakers willing to champion new bills and new policies, right? If you find yourself fitting within one of those three legs, it's important to kind of speak up or stand up. Otherwise, it's really important to be able to kind of recognize what privileges you might have, There's a classic situation Martin Luther King, was talking about during the civil rights movement about allies, white allies in particular, they can enter and exit out of a movement at any time they want to, simply on our skin tone, right? I'm a white person. And there are things that I can and can't do, but there are definitely privileges that I have, right? And I think it's important to recognize the impact that we can have in the white community, but also recognizing the respect that we need to maintain that if we're going to ally to this is a serious commitment, right? And we need to be aware that what we do may have positive or negative effects. It's just the data, it's just the research. What happens in gentrifying neighborhoods, when you see more white individuals moving in, you tend to see the neighborhood flipping. And there's a classic model, four-stage model of they say this was coined in the 70s. So the language is a little rough, but basically it said, watch where the lesbians move to, right? They said that individuals who have been marginalized are okay and willing to move to other marginalized neighborhoods. They start to use quote unquote sweat equity to build up certain areas. They want single family homes. Then you start seeing the second stage of individuals who are young families wanting to move into a certain space. And at this moment, you have diversity. But what's really interesting at that moment also is that the desires of the community, the voting position, starts to shift a little bit. And so when we're in these spaces, when we're in these communities, be careful of what our wants are, our needs are per se, versus the cultural community's threshold and needs are. The other stages are, you know, risky investment and then high gain capital investment, right? That's where it's just gone to the system at that point. But when we are in those spaces, I think it's important for us to recognize and honor, you know, those cultural spaces.
You're listening to Stats and Stories, and we're talking with Tim Thomas, director of the Eviction Research Network, about urban displacement.
You know, as you were talking and describing some of the phenomena, I found myself thinking about just that factors can be, these predictive variables can be at different levels of operation. Could be from the individual level, a household level. It could then go to kind of a community, but then ultimately structural and systemic. Could you give maybe just an example of some of the variables that seem to operate on these different levels?
Yeah, that's a great question because, you know, our dependent variable is this quote-unquote net migration rate, right? It's the inflow and outflow of low-income households. Are we seeing more or less, right? So that's our dependent variable. And the controls that we throw in there, we draw from history. Now, because, you know, this is where the beauty of data science and computing power is so great, use this Bayesian additive regression tree model, this machine learning model that takes up a lot of resources, and look at we started with over 600 features, 600 variables, right? And we whittled it down so that we could, you know, have more precision based on these features, right? I highly encourage people to look up BART models. They're really powerful and fun structurally. But, you know, we're limited to, you know, I think the individual level data is on the dependent side. That's the person moving. We count how many of those people are moving, and we use the unit of analysis of a census tract, right? We have to confine it within a certain bucket. So think about all the variables that can go in there. We have race, we have racial composition, we have income, we have housing structure. The EPA has a data set on, vulnerability scores. There's index scores. There's all sorts of different kind of scores that go on in there. And then you have larger countywide things. So, you know, it's so important to not rely on aggregated large data because you lose the detail, right, of what's going on inside a certain space. You may have something as a county looking perfectly fine, but in reality, when you look closer down at the census tract, you see that there are certain areas that are experiencing a higher or lower level of this, that, or the other, right? So we added to the census tract a, you know, dummy variable, something of whether or not it was what the voting was in that area, for example, because whether or not people voted more Democrat versus Republican kind of determined the types of policies that were being adopted and or people were ready for. We also accounted for the change, the shift in the 2020 election versus the preceding election. We also looked at, you know, those kind of like socio-political kind of dynamics. And we also looked at the infrastructure, how many affordable housing units, how many HUD vouchers were out there, right? Because all these kind of things will add to the potential for someone to be able to stay there versus not. And the top predictors are kind of what you would somewhat expect, you know, more segregated Black neighborhoods tended to see a lot more risk of eviction per se, whereas displacement was happening more in areas where there was more influx of you know, migration of people moving in. And so we were able to look and see at those details at a very high level. Voting really mattered a lot too, which was really interesting. Which, you know, to your earlier question about what can we do, make sure you vote.
How many Americans are going through this each year? And do you have a sense of whether this is a problem that is increasing or any sense of sort of like the trajectory of it?
When we created the housing precarity risk model, the first shock was how prevalent this was across the country. Mm-hmm. By and large, no one is untouched. Every city is affected, even small cities. Even rural areas in Texas are impacted. And it kind of blew me away. We had to limit this model to some degree because we just wanted people to take it and use it appropriately. So we limited every census tract to where there were more than 50 people per square kilometer. And even in that kind of limitation, even in kind of like trying to conservatize it just a little bit, there's just so much precarity going on across the entire country. And you definitely can see a lot of precarity in, the big hitters, San Francisco. You can see it in, Seattle, New York, all these different areas, Philadelphia. But what's really interesting, and this is what kind of shocked me when we did the model, was that, remember earlier I was talking about hard and soft displacement? They're not one and one, right? They don't necessarily overlap all the time. Displacement, which tends to happen to households that make 50 to 80% of the area median income, which is a HUD cutoff, for being able to qualify for certain subsidies. People making less than 50% tended to see more eviction risk, hard displacement, right? If you looked at San Francisco, which was really wild about the model, is it picked up the local policy impacts that were going on in that area. So if you look at the displacement map of San Francisco, for example, you see a lot of displacement, which makes a lot of sense. It's a very volatile neighborhood. It's moving around a lot, but they have a lot of tenant protections for eviction, and you don't see as much eviction risk there, right? And the displacement risk is huge, but the eviction risk is also, it's larger in certain spaces. But what's going on right now is we don't know much about post-pandemic America, right? The data is catching up, right? So it's very problematic right now. And I'm still giving it about 2 more years before I start analyzing this quote unquote post-pandemic America because of the delay of the ACS and the 5-year ACS. But what we see is that if we look at just raw counts of evictions, most states are evicting more people than they ever have in recorded history. Washington State, California, the Bay Area, Philadelphia, all these other spaces are really impacted. And what happened was a fundamental shift during the pandemic that people who were in that quote unquote would have been soft displacement area or potentially just hanging on, when the service sector and all the jobs kind of shut down, it really pushed a lot of people into the precarity population, if that makes sense. What we don't really pay attention to is the longevity of this. Now, all the scientists or even the public listening to this, it takes a while for certain things to gestate, to mature. And what happened during the pandemic was one of the biggest impacts. I call it, the silent depression of sorts, because it had a massive impact on people. It's going to continue to have its impact. But then on top of it, we saw a massive rapid increase in rents also happening. What was really wild, when we look at rents in particular, very urban spaces like San Francisco actually saw a drop in the average rent per month, right? That's because people were exiting out of these urban spaces. We went into, sheltering in place and all this other kind of stuff. However, every other county around there, Contra Costa County, Marin County, saw nothing but an increase, a rapid increase, a statistically significant increase in rent that it had never would have seen had it not seen migration into those urban areas, into those like more rural counties per se. And so that's causing a huge problem. Now we have the commodification too of housing, and we're moving into a subscription model of housing. So the concept of the American dream has fallen apart as well. So this, we're in a perfect storm, and the data is not mature enough to show it. But right now, I hate to say this, but I think we're in the worst period in America's history when it comes to secure housing.
That's a statement that's really hard to follow up with a question on. That is dramatic. And I'm thinking about when you're talking about the vulnerability index, and you talked about how the HUD vouchers, these housing vouchers that have existed, there was information that was being centrally provided, and there was support systems that were being centrally supported. There have been reductions in the type of data that's being collected in recent times. And the even with vouchers, which are, I can't remember the actual statistics, but you know, less than 30% of the need is met by vouchers. And even if vouchers are secured, they have to find housing. People have to find housing that will accept them. So there's fewer vouchers, and there's even fewer places taking it. What has to happen to make things better?
Honestly, we need the data. We need people championing and creating this data. So one data point, for example, that isn't easily accessible is eviction data, right? There have been efforts across the country to collect and show what's going on, but some states, you know, every court system is different, every jurisdiction is different, and some of the data is buried within the PDF image of a court record. So we can't really get a lot of information out of that unless we can digitize that. So that's what we did in Washington State, which is exactly the problem. All records are kind of held at the county clerk level, right? So you need to access that clerk's system, you need to download the PDF, and we created this NLP pipeline, basically a natural language processing pipeline, to extract the address of the individual. And that allowed us, with the last name and the address, to estimate the race of the individual. We tested that across real data, and we're within 2 to 5 percentage points of being off. And so, you know, I always tell my students, all statistics are wrong, but some are useful. And this is one of the more useful statistical, you know, models. And we were able to show that disparity, which changed the minds of the state legislatures on advancing the pay or vacate period from 3 days to 14 days. Can you imagine being evicted and having to come up with pay in 3 days? Even 2 weeks is rough, right? So what's interesting is that all of the history that, you know, we have studied in, you know, in college or all our time, I'm finding myself repeating these 101 basics, I call it, of, you know, segregation, redlining, and all this other kind of stuff. I think eviction and displacement, you know, earlier I talked about the highways of migration, are recreating concepts that we talked about segregation. So it's kind of the new redlining. It's kind of the, you know, the new problems that we're facing in discrimination.
So if someone wanted to be involved in working for better housing and working for, you know, this spectrum of need that exists in the space of housing, where should people go? How could they get started and work on this?
There's so much need everywhere. Picking up, you know, it's down to volunteering at a shelter or something, or, you know, just getting involved and being aware of the problems, you know, the one-on-one problems, to, you know, focusing on these issues. If you're going through college or, you know, the university, and you know, focusing on these issues as your core topic, right? How do we model these things appropriately? Honestly, we just need a lot more butts in the seats and hands on the keyboard. There's just so much to be done, and there's just so many places to start. You know, you can start locally. You could start, you know, you reach out to us at the Eviction Research Network. We can provide those kind of opportunities. And we actually started a consulting firm called the Collective Impact Data and Research Lab to address these issues. We take on grants and projects that tend to be small or very large, applying these statistical models for local, state, or federal agencies who need it, to try and reveal these things. Because data and data science and statistics, those are the truths that we have. Those are our tools, and they work. And they are the things that I call it creating things we can't unsee, right? We what are we going to do once we see this number, once we see this ratio? Keep it simple, keeping it, you know, obviously very simple for anybody to digest.
That's all the time we have for this episode of Stats and Stories. Tim, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Tim.
Thank you so much for having me.
Stats and Stories is a partnership between the American Statistical Association and Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film. You can follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or other places where you find podcasts. If you'd like to share your thoughts on the program, send your email to statsstories@amstat.org or check us out at statsandstories.net. And be sure to listen for future editions of Stats and Stories, where we discuss the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics.